Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Michael of Benicia. Michael, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinnie. Great to be here.
Could you elucidate as to what exactly Benicia means? Is it anything like Elysium?
Nothing at all, in fact. It is the name of what is currently known as Northumberland, or Northumbria, in northeastern Britain.
Oh, right.
And it used to stretch all the way up to about where Edinburgh is now in Scotland, all the way down to around about where York is now.
Oh.
So that's the name I take.
Okie dokie. Well, without further ado, let's get you to explain a little bit about who you are and what it is you do.
Okay. Well, I suppose the best place to start is 2008. In 2008, I got to the point where I could no longer continue to acquiesce to any part of what I saw as a tyrannical state. So in September 2008, after doing an awful lot of legal research, I ended up serving a notice of understanding and intent and claim of right upon the woman acting as the Queen of England, revoking my consent to be governed and letting her know how I was going to conduct myself from there on in. Around about 6 months later, I amended that document and it became a sovereign declaration in which I proclaimed that it was my sole mission upon this planet to found a community in which we would lay down the foundations of a society where our children would find it easier to self-realize, and we'd find it easier to self-realize ourselves. And it was called the Universal Community of Self-Realization, the nation that I founded not long after that. I declared that in March 2009, that was my intention. I received absolutely no objection from any government department or from the Queen. I also received no acknowledgement. And so I proceeded as I'd given her notice and declared that I would. And others came forward who took the same position as I, and we joined forces. And basically what we created was a community of sovereign nations, which is known as Universal Community Trust. And this community of sovereign nations has established by memorandum of understanding following six months after we had entered into a treaty, which is called the Treaty of Universal Community Trust. And we served that treaty upon the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. and we awaited their response. We received no response, and 6 months after that, we served a memorandum of understanding upon Elizabeth and the Foreign Office, in which we stated the terms of the mutual understanding that had arisen. And that basically comprises of Her Majesty's government not raising any legal objection to 12 aims and objectives that we laid down in the treaty. And I could go on and perhaps on and on, letting you know.
Actually, I'd invite you to, because I would like to hear more.
Okay, so basically these 12 aims and objectives, they set forth everything that Universal Community Trust and everyone who stands under Universal Community Trust, it sets forth everything that we are aiming to bring about. And I think probably the best way to continue is for me to actually read them to you. It won't take long if you want to go through them.
Oh, she's right. Go for your life.
The first one is an end to all crimes against mankind and the earth that are currently being perpetrated by governments, whether elected or not, corporations, organizations, individuals, and legal entities of all natures and descriptions. Two, the dismantling of all industries which, by developing, manufacturing, and exploiting for profit any substance, product, or byproduct, cause actual damage, harm, injury, or loss to mankind and or damage to the earth. Three, the deconstruction of unsustainable fiscal systems that would facilitate one man to have and one man to have not, including, without limitation, the abolition of usury in all of its forms and the demonopolization of land rights, international borders, mediums of exchange, trading platforms, and the means of communicating, publishing, and distributing information. Four, the nullifying settlement and or discharge of all outstanding or allegedly owed debts, obligations and liabilities with a view to replacing unaccountable, unsustainable and inequitable usury-based financial systems with localized and autonomous permanent credit facilities or depositories in every community that stands under the jurisdiction of Universal Community Trust. Five, the eradication of all forms of artificial scarcity and its effects, including homelessness, famine and disease, by and through the facilitation of a naturally abundant, peaceful, free and harmonious environment for mankind to dwell, and the distribution of organic materials, agricultural produce, seeds and proven natural health remedies. Six, the dissolution of mankind's dependence upon fossil fuel industries for the production of energy, including, without limitation, coal seam gas mining, coal-fired power stations and oil drilling, as well as the cessation of all toxic pollution of the biosphere of the earth in any detrimental form whatsoever, whether it be gaseous, liquid, solid or radioactive, and the closure and cleanup of all unsafe nuclear power facilities. Seven, the rapid development, manufacture, distribution and implementation of new and existing free and clean energy technologies in every community upon the earth under Universal Community Trust. Eight, a ceasefire in all wars, the repatriation of all armed services personnel following the repudiation of all unlawful allegiances and the setting aside of all oaths made in the service of private interests to the detriment of mankind, and the unequivocal commitment of the parties to this treaty to recall and withdraw any and all beneficiaries of Universal Community Trust from every armed conflict at the earliest opportunity. Nine, the establishment of cooperative trade networks in and between all communities with a view to promoting the localization of trade, self-sufficiency, mutual cooperation, and the eventual replacement of money with unconditional pledges of sweat equity, which shall form the basis for the permanent credit of every beneficiary of Universal Community Trust. 10. An agreement that privately issued promissory notes made payable to bearer on demand by any grantor, trustee, or beneficiary of Universal Community Trust may be used for the purposes of settling any valid financial obligations or to create credits in their account held at the community's depository, the balance of which will be transferable to any account in another jurisdiction, provided those credits are not used for any purpose that is detrimental to mankind and or the earth. 11. The nullifying of any and all judicial proceedings and convictions for victimless crimes, as well as the positive law which legalized such unlawful proceedings, and the prohibition and prevention of any man being charged with future crimes. 12. The facilitation of the re-emergence of the universal bond of common unity between the free indigenous peoples of the earth in order to achieve these aims and objectives in the most peaceful, amicable, and equitable manners.
It sounds very similar to a piece of legislation I myself have concocted called the Suppression of Scumbaggery Act.
Yes, yes, I believe that could be a very good subtitle for it.
Yeah. And I think that what you've got here is basically like, it's about making all of the lies of our society true again, okay? Because, you know, we've got governments to allegedly protect us, but they don't. So that lie needs to be made true so that they actually do protect us and do their job. Politicians, they promise things and they tax you for it and it's just a big lie. And I've concluded that the only thing that actually needs to make society work again is all of these systems that are big lies, just turn them into truth, and I think it'll actually work quite well.
Me too. And there's a lot of other people that think exactly the same. And a way to express it, another way to express it, is we have to reverse all the ill effects of globalization and monopolization. And without expressing what it is that's actually wrong, no one can understand what the solutions actually are. But to express it as you have so eloquently, we're basically putting the truth back into communities. We're putting the truth back into our own existence, but we're also holding the truth up for all of the programmed masses to see, because we can only do this together. We can't. There's no way that one tiny community can live like this, like we've proposed, in the world the way it is now.
Mm.
There's no way it would be possible.
Yeah, because there's two types of people in the world. Those that want to be left alone and those who won't leave you alone.
That's right. And even though the ones that won't leave us alone are a tiny minority, the vast majority of the people on the planet are still brainwashed into thinking that there is something called authority which will come down on them like a ton of bricks if they don't obey every single diktat of a tyrant.
And in most cases, they'd actually be correct, wouldn't they?
Yes, in most cases, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I think it's that's how you know that you're really not free, that you're actually a slave. I mean, you're free to watch X Factor, Big Brother, and Coronation Street, but you're not free to protest fracking.
That's right. That's right. They are attempting to, within the European Union, such as it is, to make pretty much anything that we'd want to do that would subvert the authoritarian line illegal. Now, I have to also say that while what you said before is completely true, that most of the time when you stand up to the state, you have a major problem to deal with, and sometimes they won't back down. And good, decent, honest people are being thrown out their homes by pirates and mercenaries every single day for alleged debts to banks, which any researcher who's taken more than 2 hours to look on the internet can determine for themselves that the banks do not lend any money, and they haven't for a very long time. They create credits and then charge compound interest on this electronic money that they create.
Kind of like Star Trek. And here's another point that I think actually really bears looking upon as well. If you have a look, and we're talking about a system here, okay, and everybody talks about the system, and I wanted to understand from your perspective, what is the system? Could you define it?
Yes, but the system is not the same as it was prior to 1815. So I can describe it as it has become since 1815. In the most simplistic terms, it is a globalized system of corporatist policy being imposed upon all the indigenous peoples of the planet in order to convince them that they have absolutely no choice but to live a certain way and be dependent upon the state for certain things, and to rely on the state for as many things as possible, in order that they become so compliant with the system because it provides them with everything that they think they need, that the very thought of giving up what the benefits and privileges of the system, it brings them out in hives. You know, they wake up in a cold sweat at the thought of not paying tax, of saying to the tax man, Well, I'm sorry, can you provide me proof that I have to pay you a penny from my income? And this is another topic that you may want to discuss, because I actually managed to establish with HM Revenue and Customs that I am not a taxpayer and cannot be considered a taxpayer, and I haven't received an income tax return or a demand or a letter from Her Majesty's Revenue Collectors since they accepted that they could not prove that I was any form of taxpayer. However, when I tell people that I haven't paid tax in a number of years, that I don't return the tax returns, that I don't comply with any orders of the system, that I don't feel morally obliged to comply with, they laugh at me usually, and they, or they get very nervous, because they think, they imagine what it would be like if they did that. And the system has created almost an automatic default setting of fear and anxiety when questioning any aspect of the system. And this has been done covertly. And according to my research, and I'm not the only one who's saying it, but there aren't that many of us who's saying it, this has all been done covertly by the House of Rothschild, who took control of world trade. And they already had a good hold on international finance, which they pretty much created. But they've controlled all trade since the Battle of Waterloo. Hmm. Since Nathaniel Rothschild, famously, he created a panic on the stock exchange by making everyone believe that he tipped his hat, and he sold everything he had to create the panic, and then he bought it back at a rock bottom price. And by doing so, he not only took control of the East India Company, he took control of the crown, because the crown were, for all intents and purposes, the East India Company and the Virginia Company and the East Africa Company, etc., etc.
Well, the crown realized that when you come in with a crest and a literally, I'm a king, I'm a queen, I'm a crown, or whatever. People don't like that, because they assume that you're dominating them, that you're some kind of hereditary dictator. You know, I wonder why people would think that. And so they figured out, you know what? Actually, people like corporations, because they think that there's nobody behind them. They think that it's just a normal, loving, caring entity that's just there to do business and what have you. And eventually it just kills and enslaves you, because you don't realize that they're there to kill and enslave you.
Yes. Yes, very much. And at the same time, let's look at it this way. Let's look at it this way. Since 1815, every single purported political revolution that's been written about in the history books, every single one of those revolutions was fomented by the money power of the Rothschilds and the agents of the Rothschilds. And this is provable, that there's so much evidence out there, but I have documented an awful lot of it on my website, which is selfrealization.com, for all those who don't know. Now, sorry, were you going to say something?
I was going to say, I watched a television show, I think it might have been mid last year, called The Aristocrats. Have you heard of this television show?
It goes
into the personal lives of the wealthy, rich, and powerful, and what have you. And the only reason why I watched this television show this one time is because I was flipping through the channels, and they said, "And this week we're going to be looking at the Rothschilds." And I was like, "Whoa, I'm going to watch this." You know what they did? They said, "Oh, the poor Rothschilds. They're Jewish. They're outsiders. You know, really pity. We always are afraid of getting discriminated against by people." As he sets up this like multi-million-dollar think tank facility and pays artists $1,000 per brush stroke in order to do giant murals across the freaking walls. It's like, did the Rothschilds pay these producers to make a puff piece so that people wouldn't see them for the tyrannical scum that they are? I don't give a frack that they're Jewish. I do care that they're scumbags.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's so easily demonstrated that they've controlled virtually all the mainstream media since the 80s. And they had most of it before that. But it was consolidated very much in the 80s. And then if you look at every single genocidal plan that has been implemented over the past 150 years, you will, if you follow the money, if you look for who is financing it, you will see that at the end of the line is a Rothschild or a Rothschild agent.
Mm. And Rockefellers are Rothschild agents as well, aren't they?
Either Rothschild agents or illegitimate Rothschilds.
Ah, and also this brings us into, you mentioned the word illegitimate. I interviewed Alan Watt about the elite breeding programs, and it turns out that there's this really, really incestuous relationship among the elite of the world, in some cases, quite literally.
That's right.
And I see a parallel here between the elite of the worlds being related to the New Zealand justice system. I think we've got like 160, 180 High Court justices, give or take, and I think like about 120 of them are first cousins.
Right.
So whenever you want an investigation into a corrupt judgment, the likelihood is you're probably going to get their cousin doing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Well, one of the other things that I've been heavily involved with for the past 4 or 5 years is the fight for justice over mortgages on these shores.
Mm.
And if you just consider that, by our reckoning, and there are a lot of people who have taken on the banksters on these shores now, where when we first started, there were two or three of us who were going into the courts, including the High Court, and making the claims that could be easily proven, not just by using their statutes, citing numerous judicial authorities in support of the arguments that we were making. And we could only draw one conclusion at the end of it all, when judge after judge after judge after judge threw out what we were saying as totally without merit in English law. And bear in mind, Vinny, we are citing the English law. We are citing the judgments of English judges at the minute. No. It doesn't count in this case. It may count in other cases, but you've completely misconstrued it.
You know. Really, I've misconstrued the law that's supposed to protect my rights, that's actually there to just make me believe that I've got them so that you can take them away without me knowing about it. Is that what your job is, Mr. Judge? Are you a Freemason by chance? Oh, of course you are.
and if he's not a Freemason, if he's not a member of another secret society or club, if they haven't got something on him that they can bend his arm with at any juncture over any decision that he has to make, then you can bet your ass that he will have worked in the legal professions and he will have been conveying illegal mortgages.
Mm.
And therefore, if a judge who was actually part of the conveyancing industry and took part in what we can demonstrate was knowing all-out fraud by the banks over mortgages, if such a judge would give a decision to a mortgagor who was claiming that fraud had taken place over this mortgage and that the lawyers were involved and they were the ones who advised the mortgagor to sign on the dotted line before they even owned the property that they wanted to acquire, before they had the money to acquire it, they were told by their legal representatives that they had to sign on the dotted line, that the mortgage was to remain undated. They never went over all of the terms and conditions. Therefore, if a former conveyancing solicitor is sitting and they're hearing these kind of arguments from someone like me, and there are many, many more besides, it's not just myself and a couple of other people who've taken this on. There are now hundreds, if not thousands, of people flooding the courts with these issues, and every single judge, every single one of them, has thrown the case out and dismissed it as totally without merit, because if they admitted that we were right, they would be implicating themselves in the crimes of the banks.
Hmm. Okay. What's the definition of the word mortgage?
Well, it's
from the original Latin, I think it was.
Or is it Latin, isn't it? Yes, the original. Is it death pledge?
It's death grip, I think.
Death grip.
Yeah. Like you have depth gauges, and what they do is they grip and they measure the things. I think that's the origin of the word. And it seems actually quite apt, don't you think? you know, like a smartphone.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, and I think I was interviewing Lindsay Williams this one time, and he talked about how the Fed was buying $40 billion per month of mortgage-backed securities. And I was like, I remember, what was it? Was it Jefferson that said, those who give up their liberty for security receive and deserve neither, kind of thing? And so I defined a mortgage-backed security as a death grip backed by tyranny.
That's right.
You know, and that's basically what everything breaks down to. It's and they use this language deliberately, I believe.
They do. But if you imagine that the only recourse that the judges, and these are high court judges and court of appeal judges that we're talking about here, it's not just county court judges, it's them as well. But we're talking a lot of Queen's Counsel have taken part in this. They're all closing ranks. And the only way they can stop us making these arguments in the courts is by issuing what is known as civil restraint orders against us. And they've done this against every single one who has stood up against the banks in the courts. Every single one. But none of us are willing to shut up. Because the banks cannot prove that they lent any money. And they're kicking people, as I say, innocent, good, honest, decent people out of their homes every single day. And they did it to one of my very good friends and his mother this morning. And it was violent. It was tyrannous. And it was done almost on an industrial scale. They shut a street down with riot police at 5:30 in the morning in a quiet Midlands town on this island. They shut it down, and then they set to... They had all of the equipment necessary to cut through metal, to take off the bars and the protections that they put up to keep the bailiffs out. And then they violently tore my friend and his mother from their home, and thankfully they got it all on film. It was all captured on film. And they're going to go after the bastards who've done it. And they're not the only ones, Vinny. This is going on every single day here.
Oh, it's going on globally.
Yes, it's going on globally. I also have a friend who was evicted from a charitable housing project. She was evicted over an illegal tenancy agreement by a housing association. And she's a woman who was on her own in her early 60s, and she was evicted at gunpoint. Gunpoint. The police turned up in riot gear with guns. This has never happened on these shores before the last few years.
Mm.
It has. It's been ratcheted up a lot over the past 6 months to a year.
Well, one would say, oh, that's a bit over the top. If you were a tyrannical scumbag, on the other hand, and you wanted to set an example to the other slaves of the plantation, it makes perfect sense.
Yes, exactly. And this is it. If it weren't for the cognitive dissonance of the masses, not wanting to believe that their government, such as it is, that every single one of those governments is a puppet government run by some agent of the House of Rothschild internationally. But nevertheless, if they would only not believe that their government would never set about putting into action a plan to wipe out the vast majority of the population on this planet, just the damage that Wi-Fi is doing, that enough on its own.
Hmm.
That's enough to kill fertility.
Yep. And add on to that smart meters, smartphones, everything. And then add on to that the fluoride, and then add on to that the chemical weapons and the water supply and so on and so forth. Mate, it's like, I remember a video that I made when I was a lot younger. I said, we're living in a time now where we're living in a prison cell. And every single bar within that prison cell is a separate agenda designed to screw you over. So you're completely exactly surrounded at all times with many, many, many different types of things that are just fracking up your life, everybody's life, and could quite conceivably destroy the human race in perpetuity. People don't see it, not because it's invisible, but because they can't see it, right? It's like, do you remember that old story about how Columbus was coming towards what's now the United States, he came across, I think it was some Caribbean tribes or what have you on his way there, and these tribes people couldn't see his ships. It was just not in their minds. They'd never heard or thought about such a vessel, and as a result, they physically couldn't even see them coming into shore. And indeed, it was Sharman who had to enlighten their tribe's people so that they could actually open their eyes and be able to see the ships. Now, this is an old story, but I think it actually applies today. The Rothschild banking cartel, the New World Order, those are Columbus's ships, and people like yourself and myself are the Sharman trying to teach everybody to see them.
I think that's a very good analogy. And I also, well, it's more than a very good analogy, Vinny, because I've got those shivers. I've got, you know, my spine and the hairs on my arms are standing on end. And it's not because it's freezing in the Northeast, but it is, just to let you know. Nevertheless, I think that it's gotten to the point now where I think so many people have realized, right across the planet, but I can speak more clearly from my own experiences on this island. Everywhere you go, you go out your front door, you walk down the street. If you live in a city, you see pissed off, miserable people everywhere you go. You know, and I'm sure it's like that where you live as well.
Mm.
You know, so few people are happy doing what they're doing. They're constantly distracting themselves with technology and all the rubbish that they pump out on the mainstream media. It's all distraction. None of it is good for them. How often do you see three or four people walking down the street and they're texting on their phone, and they've got no idea that they're walking past somebody else who's texting on their phone, and they're walking past each other. You know, they could be perfect for each other, and their eyes never meet because they're texting on their phone, or they're looking at their phone, reading a text. It's like, what's going on here? Is anybody actually living in the present moment anymore?
People have turned into ships passing each other in the night.
In the day.
It's terrible. It's like almost like we've become dehuman, subhuman, right? Like gradually over time, we've been genetically modified and influenced and technologically transmogrified and so on and so forth to be less than human.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. That the connection between people, when I was growing up in the Northeast here. In the 70s, the connection between people was much greater than it is now. But you put it this way, my grandparents did not start locking their doors until the 1980s. Mm. They didn't. People just used to walk in and out of their house. They lived in a pit village. They had done their whole lives. It's where they were born. It's where they died. You know, I remember as a child asking them, why do you never lock the door? Well, then, if we locked the door, no one would be able to come in.
Oh my god. Well, I suppose now it's a good idea to lock your doors anyway, because otherwise police might come in.
Yes, exactly.
And evict you from your rightfully paid home.
Well, this is it.
Yeah.
This is it.
Yeah. Alright, well, we're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. Michael of Benicia is my guest.
It's yours or if it's mine. What's the difference if it's yours or if it's mine?
And we're back. Michael Albanese is my guest. Do you have a website there?
Selfrealization.com.
Self-realization. Is it self-realization.com or just
yes,
one word?
Yes, thank you for correcting me. It's self-realization.com and realization with an S.
Ah, okay. And how long has that website been running, roughly?
Oh, it was launched in August.
Oh, okay. So relatively new there.
Yes, it is relatively new, but an awful lot of the material has been taken from my former website, freetheplanet.net, which some people might have known.
And how long had that been going for? Because I want to kind of, you know, when you want to understand, when you want to write a mystery novel, what you do is you start from the end and you work your way backwards. So can we start from today and work our way backwards to how this actually, this kind of, I would say, campaign or crusade of yours, where did it begin?
I wouldn't call it a crusade or a campaign, but I understand why you did, because you're right, you don't have the other pieces of the jigsaw. Well, I declared my own sovereignty. And I said I would live according to my own conscience, and that I would have no master. I would obey nobody. I would obey no diktat, no order, no directive, nothing. I would only agree to do something in advance of doing it. And it was difficult. It was difficult. But where this started, Vinny, and I wasn't sure if I was going to talk about this, but I think I should, because I feel like it's the right time. But in 3 days after 9/11, I met a Bilderberg insider online who was looking for a writer. And I was working in the film industry at the time. And I was writing screenplays. And she found me completely by chance. And we were both looking for someone to have a proper conversation about 9/11, about how bad it all looked, how obvious it was that something was amiss. And she confided to me that not only did she know that it was going to happen, she knew who did it, who arranged the finance, who organized the people involved, and she had known about it, along with a lot of other people she knew, since around about 98. So the 3 years preceding 9/11. She said it was a talking point in the private clubs, at the places such as on the East Coast of the US, where wives of millionaires and billionaires used to go for lunch. It was a talking point that there was going to be a staged event in New York, probably, although they didn't say it was definite, but probably in New York, that would bring about great change for the greater good. And when she confronted one of the women that she was having lunch with about this and said, "I haven't heard that. Where are you getting that from?" And she says, "Oh, pretty soon you'll hear about it." And she pressed her on it and she said, "Look, what are you talking about? Staged event. There's going to be something happening, probably in New York, and a lot of people are going to die, but it will be for the greater good in the long run. The world will become a better place because of it." And she immediately thought about what Henry Kissinger had said about needing to get rid of the useless eaters by one way or another. And her husband, at that time, as well as being a senior politician in the US, he was also an international ambassador, and she described him as Henry Kissinger's right-hand man. Now, you can imagine, I've just met this woman online. I've got no idea whether she's telling me the truth, but I know that something in my heart is telling me that I've got to follow this up. So I start asking questions, and we have numerous conversations, and we started communicating two or three times a week over a period of months, where she confessed to me that she went to her husband knowing that he was very senior in the political and diplomatic realm, and knowing that if it was going to happen, then Kissinger would know about it, and Kissinger would have told him. So she confronted her husband and said, "Have you heard about this?" And she knew from the look on his face that he had, but he didn't say anything. And she basically said, "Look, I'm horrified by this. I think someone should alert the media. If you are saying this is actually happening, or this is going to happen, then someone needs to warn the people of New York." And at that moment, she told me that she knew her marriage was over, because the look on his face, it was a look she'd never seen before. And he said, "Whatever you do, don't do that." And their marriage hit the skids, as you can imagine. They had children, and he desperately tried to patch it up with her, and she wasn't sure whether to trust him. So she gave him a chance and agreed to go on a make-or-break holiday in Africa. And they went to Kenya. And his attitude changed completely towards her. And she was even starting to wonder if she could trust him again. And maybe she'd misread the way he reacted. And because her attitude was softening, she agreed to allow him to go during the holiday and have a breakfast meeting with another diplomat, and agreed to meet him at the US Embassy in Nairobi. And she was sitting there 5 minutes after he'd said that he was going to be there, and she realized he was late for the very first time in their marriage, to her recollection, and she knew something terrible was about to happen. And then the US Embassy exploded. It was the Nairobi bombing. The two explosions. That was blamed on Al-Qaeda. And she immediately knew. Well, in that moment, she said, 1,000 things went through her head in 1 second. And she woke up in the arms of a man who had pulled her from the burning rubble. And she didn't know who he was, but he saved her life. He took her to a hospital, which I think was on the outskirts of the city, because all of the city's hospitals were jam-packed. There were so many people injured and killed in these explosions. And most of them either worked in the US Embassy, or they were walking past or working near the US Embassy. It was a horrendous sight. The carnage was appalling. So she was one of the lucky ones. And he took her to a place to recuperate and nursed her back to health. And they ended up, one thing led to another, and they ended up basically sharing their stories. And of course, the first thing that she wanted to know is how it happened, how it came about that he pulled her from the burning building, once she realized what had happened, the explosion, once she came to. And he told her that he was a private mercenary who had been offered a job setting up the bombing at the embassy to blame it on Al-Qaeda, but he hadn't wanted to do it, and he pulled out when he found out that there were quite likely to be innocent civilians on the casualty list. But because of his conscience, he went to the scene to see if there were any survivors who he could pull out of the rubble, which is exactly what he did with her. And this obviously led her to confess to him what she knew about the forthcoming staged event. And of course, he confirmed that that was what was going to take place. And the reason? He'd also been asked to take part in the setting up of that event. So this is what she told me. She also told me about the guy who provided the financial front for the operation of 9/11, and that the front was an Indian tea deal, and that was the vehicle that they used to provide cover for the channeling of the money to the mercenaries. And it turned out that the guy who saved a life was having trouble with his conscience over having been asked to be involved in the 9/11 event, in the staging of it, he decided that he was going to pull out. Because, again, for the same reason, once he found out that there were likely to be innocent people killed, he pulled out. And he was very concerned that his life was going to be taken by the organizer, but it turned out that it wasn't, because the guy, the real architect, the true architect, the one who actually laid down the plans of bringing such an event to fruition, a man with sufficient malevolence to do something like that, is someone who would probably take out his nearest and dearest if he thought they were a threat to him, let alone someone who he just treated as a casual friend or acquaintance. But it turned out that they had history together in the private mercenary business, and he owed him one. So he didn't get assassinated, and he kept his mouth shut. In fact, the only one he told was this woman. And it ended up that he went back to, or they parted at the airport when she was recovered, and she went back to see what was awaiting her at home. And she was told, as soon as she got there, by her husband, who didn't even question her on what had happened. It was like he knew already, and he said, "The marriage is over, I want a divorce, you've been adulterous." And there was a very messy divorce, and she eventually settled and went back to live where her family originated, in Northern Europe. So she tells me all of this, Vinny, and I don't know when you started researching 9/11, but 3 days after 9/11, and for the next 2 to 3 years, it was very difficult to find any hard evidence. There were lots of theories, but to find all the pieces of the jigsaw and put them together to cross-reference all this information that I was given, because that's the pledge that I made to this woman. She said, "Please keep my name out of this," because she was moving to the other side of the world with her family in hiding, because she'd been threatened when she left her husband. She'd been threatened that she had to keep her mouth shut about everything, and they were very worried that she was going to open her mouth after she left. And she knew that she was being bugged, and she was being followed everywhere she went, and she was secretly arranging to go to the other side of the world into hiding. And I haven't heard from her since it happened. But before she went, on the day she went to the airport, she rang me, and we had a conversation. And I promised her that I would cross-reference all the information she'd given me, and that I wouldn't let it out into the public domain until I'd managed to cross-reference all of the facts that could be fact-checked. And everything that she told me, Vinny, everything has checked out. There isn't any aspect of it that hasn't. There's been so much research done by other researchers that proves the things that she told me were true. And the evidence that there was an attempt to take her out in the US embassy bombing, Why, it's unequivocal. She was virtually the only one who wasn't acknowledged in the media. And there were preordained reports ready to go out just after the embassy was bombed.
What did this do to you emotionally? Because when I discovered 9/11 and the things, I think it was Mike Rupert from theWilderness.com. Have you ever heard of him? Former narco, actually. And I saw a documentary of his called The Truth and Lies of 9/11, very low budget, just a presentation in a hall that he did. And my reaction wasn't fear or, oh my God, this is so terrible and what have you. My reaction was hysterical laughter, because all of these connections and all of these people involved in everything like that was so out in the open that it was practically a joke.
Yeah. It's a very good question, because I was as horrified by what she told me as I'd ever been in my life. And mainly because I knew that I could not continue to live the way I'd been living anymore. Because I'd already, two or three years before that, I'd started researching the Bilderberg, so I knew a little bit about what she was talking about. And this was kind of a sign to me that I needed to move in a different direction. because yeah, I had a career in the international film business, and you know, while I left because of the inherent corruption within it, and the fact that it is one of the dirtiest industries imaginable. You know, the people who do well are the ones who will shaft anybody on their way up. And I didn't want to work in that kind of environment. I felt that my creativity was being affected adversely. And as soon as the technology arrived to make my own films, I left it all behind. And I had in the back of my mind that what I would do was write a book imagining a world without money. And that's what I started writing. It was called A World Without Money. And it was to imagine a world where something like 9/11 couldn't happen, where you didn't have the money to pay the mercenaries to organize such a malevolent thing, where there wasn't the money available so the House of Rothschild could continue to control everything covertly and unaccountably, you know, or anybody like that, where it just wasn't possible. And that's what led to, I can only say that I didn't do it consciously, but I did self-destruct. I shed from my life everything and everyone, including wives, who didn't accept me for exactly who I was. And it ended up that the only people left, apart from me, were the ones who really cared. And that was a handful of very good people who helped me through a very dark time. But when I was on my way out of that very dark time, I knew, because there was a fireball of rage every single day when I got up in my belly, that I had to do something about it. I couldn't even contemplate fatherhood unless I had a handle on what I was going to do to make the world a better place. Because I didn't want to bring a child into this mayhem without knowing how to keep them free and safe from the tyrants. You know, and this is what, well, I was lucky enough to meet the mother of my children during this period. Would you believe? In all of the darkness, I'm stumbling. I honestly didn't even remember who I was, and yet she recognized me. And when we were pregnant with our daughter, we had a long conversation about registration. And now at this point, I'd revoked my consent to be governed. I'd established by declaration that I wasn't going to give a single penny, no matter what they said, to a criminal government to spend it on the killing of innocents in foreign shores. Mm-hmm. And when this was established, and I'd gotten rid of some fraudulent debt with credit card companies, energy bandits, and I'd gotten to a point where I didn't have any outstanding issues. And I said to my wife, we really can't register. We can't. We just can't do it. So she said, research it, have a look into it, and then we'll talk about it again. Because she knew it would be a big deal. She knew it would instinctively. She's very perceptive and very courageous as well, I have to say. And when I'd researched it, I came back and said, look, the worst that can happen, if they take us to court and I haven't been able to find a single case where someone's been prosecuted, the worst that can happen is a £2 fine. And she said, go for it. We'll do it. We can't do it. It's not the right thing to do. It isn't. Because what I'd also found out in my research was there was a direct link between registering a child and money going into the war chest for illegal wars. In 1929, the criminal government of the United Kingdom created an act called the Government Annuities Act 1929. And this act allowed the Comptroller General to create life annuities in the name of everybody who was registered. And this life annuity is a dividend that's paid every quarter that the beneficiary, the child, is entitled to, but only if it is claimed within the first 7 years. And of course, these facts aren't disclosed to any parents who are registering their children. Therefore, they don't know that they've got to claim the annuity. Otherwise, it's just going to escheat to the crown. And that money gets consolidated by statute into what is known as the Consolidated Fund, which is what they draw on to go to war and many other things. So once I'd explained this to my wife, there was no way we could do it. No matter what they said, no matter what they did, we weren't going to back down. We weren't going to allow our daughter to contribute to the killing of innocents in any way. And especially we weren't going to create a tacit contract with the state for her to become a taxpayer, for them to interfere in her life, for them to send endless letters trying to emotionally blackmail us into getting her vaccinated to put poison into her veins. You know, as everyone who registers, they get these letters telling them that they're doing the wrong thing by not vaccinating. They get told, you know, that their child could have serious problems if they don't. So we took on the Crown and the registrar over the registration. And they said, well, if you don't register, then she's not going to be able to go to school. Well, we're unschooling her, so that's no problem. And that's going phenomenally well, I have to say. She's almost four and she's thriving. Let's just say she's thriving. And we also told the Crown that they weren't entitled to have any of the information pertaining to her very existence because it was private family trust property. Because we created a private family trust and all of the property pertaining to my legal fiction, the name on my birth certificate and the name on my wife's birth certificate, we granted into private trust and the beneficiaries are our children. And that's everything. That's that we have no form of income, or rather my wife does have a form of income. She has one foot in the system. She's a teacher. But she's a very, very good teacher. She's helping children to think for themselves. But she will give that up at a certain point in time when we are financially more able.
I think that she'll wind up getting herself fired at that point, you know.
Look, you teach the children to think. I don't like it. I don't like it at all. You're going to have to go home now. I'm going to cut off your benefits. You know, as you're telling me this really amazing story, it just something occurred to me. I'm a talk radio show host. I do it 5 days a week. It's amazing what the knock-on effects can be from a single important conversation in your life.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's probably the reason why I wanted to express it to you, because I envisaged that we would be talking about every aspect of what's happened to me over the past few years. And it is a story that has never been told publicly, and it's only been told privately to a handful of my most trusted.
Well, I feel very privileged at that point then.
Well, you know, I think this is a very good medium for it, Vinny. And, you know, there is no one doing what you're doing in the way that you're doing it. And, you know, the level of, or rather the quality of the guests that you have on your show, the information that you're putting out, and the fact that you want to have a laugh with it all, I had no hesitation in accepting your very kind invitation.
Oh, well, I guess, I don't know, I guess I'm pretty arrogant and sort of the thing is just like, yep, pretty much. You know.
So you already know that.
Yeah. It's kind of like, what was it? The Matrix. What does the Oracle have above the doorway to the kitchen? Know thyself.
Yeah.
And these kind of things. In fact, do you recall? I watch a lot of movies. There was a film with Nicolas Cage in it called Bringing Out the Dead.
I do. Yes, I didn't see it, but I do recall it.
Well, there's this, I think it might have been Patricia Arquette in it. She's talking to Nicolas Cage and. She's only just met him, like, about 5 minutes ago, and she starts telling him her life story, and all these traumas and everything that happened to her, and she suddenly realizes what she's doing, and she stops herself, and she goes, Jesus, does everybody just spill their guts on you like this? And he says, it must be my eyes. My mother always said, I've got the eyes of a priest. And I feel that I've kind of embodied a lot of the ways that it might not just be my eyes. It's just my mannerism. I am a trustworthy person. I am a caring person. And I ooze it out without thinking about it, you know, because I've trusted so many other people in my life that have turned up screwing me over. And yeah. So I have chosen to model myself on the person who is the direct antithesis to that. So somebody who does not violate somebody's trust, somebody who you can bear your soul and your heart with without fear of rejection or judgment.
Yes.
And that is sorely, sorely fracking missing in talk radio, even in the sphere of talk radio from which I operate within. There's so many other hosts that I've listened to, and I get the impression that they don't actually care about these people that they're talking to.
I can't listen any further once I make that deduction.
Me neither.
I just stop. I turn off and I never go back.
Yeah. Because it's this this lack of empathy within humanity that is driving us apart. And it means that if you want to accomplish something that is different to what's normally happening, you actually have to spend all day, every day at it in order to just to keep it alive, let alone That's right. make it thrive.
That's right. That's right. And at the same time, you must also be acutely aware of how different it is now to how it was 3 years ago. Mm. You know, I mean, you couldn't even mention... You still couldn't mention 9/11 being an inside job or 7/7 or anything like that without people saying you were a crazy conspiracy theorist nutcase.
Mm.
You know, I've heard all that. I've looked on the internet. You know, there's nothing to it. I saw the BBC documentary. They rebutted it all. Well, no, they didn't. But now you got a situation where you can even say to somebody who you don't even know, who you're having a conversation with just by chance, that you bump into them in the street and you just have a conversation. You can even say, of course, the banks are screwing everybody. And they'll nod and say, yes, they are.
Mm.
And I was going to make the point before, in every revolution that was orchestrated by the House of Rothschild since 1815, and probably it would actually be the 50 years before 1815, they started doing it with the French Revolution. And I was going to say, oh God, I think I've lost my thread there. I was going to tell you about what was that subject that I was relating to there?
It was about how revolutions begin and how there is an awakening going on, how people are more open and they agree with things automatically, kind of thing.
Yes, it was that, but unfortunately, it hasn't come back. If it comes back, I'll let you know.
Well, because when you were saying that, what occurred to me is the 100th monkey syndrome, and for those who don't know what it is. There was a study conducted, I forget who or when, I don't know the exact details, but there were monkeys who had figured out that if you used a stick and then you put it into a termite mound, many termites would bite onto the stick, and then you could pull it out and you could actually eat the termites off the stick. And these biologists, I think, were quite fascinated by this. And they were in touch with their colleagues around the world via a telegram or letter or whatever it was at the time. And they found something very interesting, that other monkeys around the world who were separated by continents started doing the exact same thing to termite mounds in their areas of the world. And the conclusion was that as soon as an idea is spread amongst enough members of a particular species, the whole species somehow wirelessly is capable of picking up on those skills, those ideas. Yes. And this is most... well illustrated, I believe, in the human race with the invention of the telescope. Many people don't know that the telescope was invented by 9 men at different points around the world on the exact same night, and none of these men knew each other at all.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
perhaps we are living in a time now where everybody will be able to see with the distance and the clarity of their own intellectual telescope because of people like us.
Well, that would certainly be the aim, that we would help facilitate that. And I remembered what the point was, and it does link into this conversation. In the testimony of lots of communists who were involved in the Russian Revolution, and and some of them were Trotskyites who were involved in the first government. One of them was called Christian Rakovsky, and there are others who have testified the same. In all of the revolutions that have been sponsored by the House of Rothschild, the people involved in the actual revolution, they take everything except the banks. The banks are left standing. Their buildings are never burned, they're never robbed, they're never looted. They're always left exactly as they were. That's why it's such an important observation to make, that all of a sudden we do find ourselves in a place where all respect has been lost for the banksters. All respect.
They don't deserve any in any way, and I believe that's on the road to a just society, is recognizing that there is a magician, and he's not gifted with magic, he's only a glorified trickster.
Exactly.
We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Michael of Bernicia. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My very special guest is Michael of Bernicia. And what was your website just one more time with the dash in it?
Self-realization.com.
There we go. Self-realization.com. Okay. Whew. All right. Now, in terms of health, there's a number of different ways of it. You know, there's physical health and your mental health and your spiritual health and what have you. And I think what's happened to society, and I'm pretty sure you'll agree with me, is that all forms of health are under attack. At least for those of us slaves of the plantation. The rest of people, on the other hand, it's probably only a couple of thousand people, know precisely what's going down, and will not touch GMOs, only have the finest fluoride-free water, and continue to tell us all that it's good for us, while not practicing what they preach, like the royal family, for instance. And I think that's a microcosm of everything, I think.
It is. It is. I agree. Have you seen any of the research that I've done on the illegitimacy of the English monarchy?
No, but frankly, I barely even need to see any research in order to think that the British monarchy is illegitimate.
Right, I agree.
Just
I
in
agree.
General, no. Just upon general assumption, they're illegitimate, you know?
Of course, but wouldn't you be interested in a legal argument that is without weakness, that could actually take down the crown in a court that wasn't a rigged game?
I'd be more in favour of beheading, but let's do it your way instead.
Well, what if I just attempted to whet your appetite a little bit more by saying that it would mean, if my argument is correct, it would mean that there is no valid law either in the United Kingdom of ill-gotten gains or any of Her Majesty's so-called dominions.
I'm kind of already on that playing field, yeah.
Right, okay. Well, the argument is very simple. The British laws of a king called Divinwal Molmud, they became the laws of the lands of Britain in 400 BC. And the feudal system was imposed upon them in breach of those laws by the Anglo-Saxon king Alfred the Great in, I think it was, the 9th century. And then by the time of the Anglo-Saxon Norman Rome-sponsored Norman conquest in 1066, that pretty much destroyed all of the remaining indigenous peoples of Britain who had followed the Molmutine laws. And the Molmutine laws stated that the only way that those laws could ever be suspended was by a unanimous convention of the people. Because under the Molmutine laws, the people were above the king or the lord. The king had no more rights than any other man or woman. They just had different roles and responsibilities. Now, I'm going to cut to the chase here and say that while it's a very, very interesting read, and I have it up on the website, the Molmutine laws can be found in the Our Stories section at selfrealization.com. It's a very interesting read, and it's certainly not the case that all of them could be applied now, but a lot of them, they have been in the past for many centuries. And the feudal system is anathema to the Molmutine laws. In other words, it could not be ever lawfully imposed upon it, which means that no laws of any of the so-called Anglo-Saxon kings of England from the beginning to the present day, none of those laws are valid. Every single one of them is void ab initio. Every single one of them. Which means there isn't even an argument for a legitimate state in any so-called Commonwealth country.
I thought that was because of just pure logic, but you've actually found a historical legal argument in order to prove it.
That's my position, yes.
Well, I think this is a good idea, actually, because what I find strange about... You've heard of the golden rule, haven't you? The gold makes the rules. I saw this film called 3,000 Miles to Graceland. And they were these criminals that just robbed a casino, and they were sitting around this table with all of this money. And one of them had died, and they were divvying up his stash. And the leader was like, no, it's like Kevin Costner. And one of the little guys doesn't like what he's saying, that he wants to keep his money, right? And so he pulls out his gun and he puts it on the table. And the leader says, "You've forgotten the golden rule." And he shoots him underneath the table. And he says, "He who has the nickel plated makes the rules." And I think that this is precisely the reason why all laws and states and institutions have been implemented and maintained, not by the rule of law, but by the golden rule of "he who has the nickel plated makes the rules."
Correct. Correct. There is no form of legitimate government except self-government. It is a myth that there is any legitimate form other than self-government.
Yeah, I saw this great picture on Facebook one time. Oh, no. Actually, it was Mark Passio. Mark Passio from whatonearthishappening.com showed this picture in one of his presentations. It says, statism. It's the brilliant idea that you give the government the power to kill and intimidate and steal to protect you from other people who might kill, intimidate, or steal from you.
Right.
And it was like, whoa. and this goes back to what we started off with in the beginning, is that in order to make the world a better place, you've simply got to make all those lies true. And you're not making them true again, because they were never true to be in the first place. 9/11 was never true in the first place. People had genuine reactions, but they were based on a lie. Everything's based on a lie. It's almost as if the justification from our society is a house built on sand, and it is shifting beneath our feet every moment, so long as we sit back and just realize, my God, we've got foundations of sand. The elite know this, and I think that they are getting quite concerned about the growing awareness of the human race, about their dominance, about their scumbaggery. I fear what kind of implementation of the golden rule that they'll use next in order to suppress this awakening.
I've been wondering that myself, and I do think that the sudden gift of, if you can call it that, of Wi-Fi in all of the schools, so on this island, is an example of how they are ratcheting up the tyranny, because they've given it away for free because they know that the research has already been presented to virtually every government on the planet, certainly every Western government, by the top researchers and doctors who've been looking into this subject, the effects, the potential ill effects of Wi-Fi, and they've discovered that a shockingly high proportion of pregnancies within the first 6 weeks. I think it's over 60% of pregnancies in the first 6 weeks terminate. Some women don't even notice when this happens. They just think they're having a heavy flow that month. And I know a lot of women who've been complaining of such things since the advent of Wi-Fi, whereas I never noticed it being so common before. And when you look at the research, and again, there's an article on Wi-Fi, a thalidomide in the making at selfrealization.com, which lays all of this out in great detail. The governments have rejected the research. They've refused to act. They are knowingly putting Wi-Fi in the schools to eradicate your children's chances of propagating the species, because the harm that it does to the follicles that become the ovaries in young girls, it's irreparable. And it breaks my heart to even contemplate it.
You know what? I think this is the basis of the script for the film Children of Men.
Is it?
Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily, not quite literally, but in the film Children of Men, the entire world is infertile.
Right.
The youngest person in the world is like 28. And the whole thing is a world crumbling in on itself, breaking under its own weight, because there are no new people being born whatsoever. There is no way to replace the human race. And everybody knows in their heart that they're about to go extinct.
Well, I believe that the current birth rate in Europe is 1.1. And when I was at school, however long ago that was, it was 2.2. So it's halved since I was at school. And people need to understand, they say, oh, well, you know, it could be worse. Well, no, not really, because you've already halved the population of the planet if that continues. But it's getting worse. It's on a downward slide. It hasn't leveled off.
Yeah.
We don't have any time to wait anymore. The people need to rise up. It's as simple as that. And it's got to happen not by orchestration. It's got to happen because the will of the people is there. It is there. They just need the right catalyst.
Now, what gives people the impetus to lay their life on the line for the lives of others? For me, it was combination of fear and anger, I guess, afraid of my own extermination, and angry at the people who were concocting schemes to bring it about. That was me, at least. How do you inspire that kind of fear and anger in others is what I've been trying to figure out. And the answer is, maybe I shouldn't have been so afraid and so angry in the first place, because I've become a lot calmer since understanding a little more. And I think that's what fear and anger is propagated by, is a lack of understanding.
Totally. I was shivering under the duvet with fear at the brown envelopes that were going to be dropping on the doormat every single morning. I had Crown agencies coming after me, trying to issue legal proceedings against me for money I did not owe them, the alleged debts that they couldn't corroborate in any way, shape or form, but they were threatening me with prison if I didn't capitulate. I was absolutely crapping my knickers, Vinny, and I woke up one morning and I sat up in bed and I just said, no more, I'm not going to be scared anymore, that's it. And then I was angry, and that anger, it dissipated the moment that I realized what I'd done. Is I told the Queen that she was going to assume to be the boss of me no more, and that every state agency had backed down because of the missives that I sent them, not because I was in hiding, not because they didn't try to stop me. They did. They couldn't, because I only stood on the truth. So when people are scared at the very thought of what might happen in the future, they're ignoring the moment. And that's what I realized in myself. I was living in the anxiety of what I couldn't control anyway. And because I was doing that, I was forgetting to do with the moment what I needed to do to progress in my life. And then I realized, when I look back, I'd spent too much time having depression about what had happened in the past and how I would have done things differently now, because I was living in a godless, ego-driven world. I hadn't realized the true nature of this universe. I hadn't gotten anywhere near to even acknowledging that there was a creator of this universe, because I was a recovering Catholic and then a recovering atheist. And I think the two go in tandem quite often. But now, you know, there's no religion that I would ever adhere to, because it's just another mind program. But government, as many people, I think Mark Passio, Larkin Rose, have both said this, any form of government is just another form, any form of acceptance of government is just another form of acceptance of a religion, of a religious doctrine, that this is what must happen, and there's no getting around it.
Yeah. I've kind of been thinking about this lately, as there's stages, and it occurs to me that the people in the so-called truth movement are suffering from a form of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Most of us are, I think.
Now, I've got a couple of things that are wrong with me, like, what's my one? I'm employophobic. I have a panic attacks if I'm about to get a job and be employed and have somebody tell me what to do. I'm policeophobic. I am deathly terrified of being arrested again. And these fears that I have paralyze me, and I've had to withdraw entirely from being in those situations where I might be employed or might be arrested, you know. And my life's actually turned out a hell of a lot better since avoiding those things, strangely enough. And what occurred to me is that losing your current view of reality, basically shattering the lie that is people's perception of reality and actually looking beyond the veil, is akin to the grief process of losing a loved one. You know, there's certain things where, you know, yeah, first you get your depression, then your anger, and then your acceptance, right? And I think this is what's happened to a lot of us, as we go from fear to anger to acceptance, then to action, and then to empowerment. And there is, you can go through that level. Some people get stuck way back here, stuck in the fear or stuck in the action or you know, but you can't go back once you've reached the empowerment stage, I think.
No, you can't. There is no going back. And I also think, certainly from my own experiences, that the most difficult periods are where you have to act to bring something about every single day, and it's relentless, and there's nothing you can do about it. And that means that you don't have the time to sit down and reflect on your actions, to learn from what's happening and to observe all of the circumstances that are arising. Because, I mean, let's face it, most people's lives are complicated by the bullshit that they don't need to have in their lives, but they have to deal with it because it's there, it's imposed upon them.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like having children, you know, your life is suddenly not your own, and it's not something that you can just, you know, take a holiday from or give up on or something of that nature. It's constant and it's inescapable, and you just have to deal with it.
Well, I'm a full-time dad, and obviously all the work I do, most of the work I do from home. And I'll tell you a little story about my daughter, just to let you know what kind of character she is. She basically was at a bouncy castle a few months ago, and this was an indoor bouncy castle, and there were lots of three-year-olds around, and they were bouncing up and down on the castle, and there was a little boy who went up to her, was going up to little boys and girls and pushing them down and jumping with his knees on their chests and making them cry. And he was enjoying it. You know, so I mean, who knows what he's been sitting in front of in his house to be acting like that, you know, enjoying the psychosis at that age. But anyway, obviously I saw this happen, and I get to my feet and I'm just about to intervene, but my daughter had seen it, and she jumped up and she said, "No, don't you do that. That's wrong." And he got up and he looked at her and he smiled and he went for her, and she grabbed his arm and threw him down and said, "No, you shouldn't be here. Stop it." And she stopped him. She stopped the bully. Now, but she didn't just stop the bully. She stopped someone bullying somebody else, other people, and prevented him from getting anywhere near from bullying her. And that isn't because we've put her up to it. I've discussed what might happen in certain situations, but I haven't instructed her what to do. She did it instinctively. And if I was to identify what it is about my character which has driven me to take the course that I have, is I have no choice. I am unable, and always have been, to do what I'm told. I'm not going to do it. And she's the same. I haven't taught her it, and I don't believe it's genetic. She's just like it's the natural law philosophy that Mark Passio has so eloquently expressed. Mm. We all know in our hearts what is right. Our children aren't born ignorant. They're not even born nescient. Our children are born understanding what we convey to them. And it's only when parents, they think, oh, well, they don't understand anything. It doesn't matter what we say. It doesn't matter what they overhear. It doesn't matter what they see. They don't know what it is yet. It's not true. It's not true.
Oh, they absorb everything.
Everything. From the beginning. From the first moment.
Mm.
It's also the most wonderful experience that I've ever had, being able to spend this much time with my daughter. And it breaks my heart when I think that the vast majority of parents are being forced through financial concerns to give their children to strangers, to put them into strangers' care, and miss out on not only the most important years of their lives, but the most amazing years. These are the years where if you get it wrong, their lives are going to be a mess.
Mm. Like the Jesuits said, what was it? Give me a child until the age of seven and I will give you the man, or something to that effect. And it is these formative years which I believe the establishment is attempting to literally steal from parents in order to reduce the possibility that free-thinking children can even exist anymore. The United Nations programs, Agenda 21, Codex Alimentarius and whatnot, I'm sure you're aware of these, have an enormous reach into high school, primary school, and now they're reaching into kindergarten, and they're reaching even further back now into preschool, even before the children go to kindergarten, daycare, and what have you. So it's going to be like this. People will not even remember in a couple of generations' time what a family or a parent even is. They will think. They will think.
If this doesn't stop,
yeah,
that's exactly what will happen. It'll be Huxley's dystopian vision come true.
Mm. It's a dirty word, family, in the minds of the elite. Ironically, it's their family that runs everything. And this is something else. I love Mark Passio. Like, he's just got such brilliant. He's just got such brilliant stuff that he comes up with.
How many people can you sit down and listen to for 7 hours?
I can't. Seriously, nobody ever. I mean, even David Icke's presentation at Wembley. I mean, one of my mates brought around his 4 DVDs. It was like a 10-hour lecture or something like that. You could listen to it, but every hour or so, you just kind of like nod off for a few minutes, and you kind of go to sleep, and then you wake up and you go, oh, okay, but Mark Passio. It's like just this attention grabbing, like yes, this intensity, this crescendo builds up, and what he's what he was saying, I think, was about New Age BS and how there is no what they're saying and trying to indoctrinate people into this new religion where there is no objective truth, where there is no such thing as natural law, where there is no such thing as good or evil. And, oh, this was the point that I almost forgot. The elite know all of these lessons, and they know that those lessons give you power, and so it is part of their agenda to ensure that we don't get those lessons, so that none of us have any power to challenge them with.
Yeah, children are being taught how not to think, how not to think critically, how not to ask questions, just to repeat and memorize answers that are preordained, that are never investigated, and are virtually all wrong.
Yeah.
And it is so simple to teach yourself how to critically think, even if you've had your head stuck up your ass your entire life, that all you need to understand is the basics of the trivium. And once you start applying it, once you start understanding what information is, what its logical sequence is, and what the inevitable conclusion is in that order, once that happens, then nothing can be the same again. It can't be the same. You understand that the reason why the dumbing down in the education system is so advanced is because they're insisting that rhetoric is placed first at all times. Mm. So they're giving them the wrong answers, and they're telling them, shut up, just accept it.
That's
put your
right.
hand down.
In fact, I had this realization when I was at university. I only managed to do 2 years of it before I quit saying this entire thing is BS. When you talk to some people who are educated in university about some of these subjects that you and I discussed, subjects which have evidence that are real, that exist, that are provable, documented, etc., they're in complete denial of it. Or they say that you're crazy or something of that nature. And a profound realization hit me. They all think that they've been taught critical thinking in university, right?
Yeah.
But the realization was, for me, that university does not teach people to think critically. It teaches people to be critical of people who can still think.
Yes, it does. It does.
And, of course, these graduates go on to become your leaders. And they pass it on. It's like Chinese whispers, except in passing along, instead of passing along words, you're passing on insanity.
Yes, that's very true.
And the insanity gets so skewed that it's not even recognizable as insanity anymore. It's like it reaches new levels.
It does.
It's something that Alex Jones says all the time on his radio show. You just crack out laughing. The level of it, you know, the level of it. And he's right, you know. I've realized that the difference between good and evil is good characterizes itself by having restraint over itself. Evil characterizes itself by having no restraint over itself. That's why there's no upper limit to tyranny. There's no upper limit to scumbaggery. But there are many limits and examples of what good is. And I think that is what we're supposed to be here on this frickin' plane of existence, this planet, whatever your perception tells you that you're experiencing right now at this very moment, if you ain't doing something good, then you're either helping evil to succeed or you're helping good to die, right? Which helps the evil to succeed. It's by default. And it is because you restrain yourself from doing good rather than doing good by restraining yourself.
I think that's very well put. It also reminds me of one of my many appearances in court. I've generally appeared when I'm helping other people in legal matters, including my own family, under a power of attorney that grants me the right to act in their name. And exercise a right of audience. And I was doing this in the High Court in one of the mortgage-related cases that I've been fighting it since 2010. And my family's properties are on the line. They're at great risk of being stolen by the Crown for the second time in my life. And I was in the High Court with a judge who'd heard he'd let me say everything I wanted to say. He complimented me, which with what I perceived as sincerity, saying that what I'd presented was erudite. That he implied that there were obviously several merits within the argument that I'd put forward, but he said that in this case he was unable to go into those merits, because a court of appeal judge had refused permission to appeal on paper without a hearing, without going into any of the merits of the case. And he said, therefore, I'm unable to do anything except dismiss this as totally without merit. So I said to him, a system of justice that cannot deliver justice is void ab initio and must be struck down. And then he thanked me for the way I'd conducted myself. And this was in the High Court Chancery Division. To the best of my knowledge, this is unprecedented, but it stands as an example that I effectively declared that the courts of so-called justice on these shores are void because they are putting the interests of the banks above the law and above those of the people. Instead of protecting the people from the tyranny of the banks, they are allowing the banksters to run amok and steal from everybody with impunity. And if that is the case, why do we continue to go into those courts and ask for remedy from the representatives of tyrants? Why do we do it?
I think it's force of habit, you know?
It is.
You know, it's like it's like Pavlov's dogs.
Yeah.
To a degree, you know, we've been psychologically trained and corralled into this narrow vision or spectrum of thought, and it's very difficult to escape. It's like a single electron attempting to, shall we say, separate itself from the other electrons in the beam of a laser that is shooting in one direction and one direction only. Okay, one electron decides, you know what, I'm not going to go the same direction as all the other electrons, but he's still getting pushed along by this laser beam, isn't he? And that's the psychological difficulty of what we're dealing with. We have a laser-focused, scientific, psychological castration going on here.
Yeah, there's no doubt. But that what about all of the things that everybody who is currently living in the Matrix? What about all of the things that they can do today to help themselves step out and realize exactly what's going on for themselves? They don't need to be told. Stop watching television. Stop listening to any mainstream radio. Stop buying so-called newspapers. Look for your information online. There's enough good information out there. It doesn't take long to realize what is going on. Walk outside your front door and look up in the air. Look at what they're spraying. Look at the evidence that on geoengineering and chemtrails and the poisons that they're pumping out into the stratosphere, which again are attacking fertility. They're attacking the earth. They're preventing plants from growing in the normal way. Then you've got the nuclear radiation that is pumping out of Fukushima every single minute of the day into the ocean.
Yeah. Hey, you know what this reminds me of? It reminds me of that conversation Morpheus was having with Neo in The Matrix. And he goes, what is The Matrix? He says, The Matrix is The Matrix is the tyrannical system, right?
Yeah.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us, even now in this very room. You can see it when you turn on your television, and you can hear it when you turn on your radio. You feel it when you pay your taxes.
And it's watching everything we do right in this moment.
Yeah, and I saw another great post on Facebook yesterday. It says, Big Brother is watching you. Give him a good show. And I think I'm doing that, you know. It's the Vinnie Eastwood show, you know. I'm glad that the NSA, or as the Mexicans would pronounce it, the NSA, is listening to this very listening to us at this very moment. I mean, right now we're pre-recording this. This is not live, so the listeners cannot listen to this while it's being recorded. But the SA that begins with an N can. And I find that actually quite wonderful because, hey, I've got audience members that I can't even calculate. Isn't that lovely? And I hope that all of you listening to us right now, at this very second, before it's even published, really appreciate the privilege that you have to get a sneak peek at this episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, which is quite fabulous indeed. We're going to break now. We'll be right back in just a few minutes, folks. Don't you go anywhere. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. The final segment here now with Michael of Benicia. And we have had quite the conversation. I'd like to just give you the opportunity now. How has this talk been for you thus far?
It's been extremely enjoyable, even if I am a little bit bleary-eyed. I've been up for over 15 hours now, so...
Sweet mercy.
Doing well.
Okay, well, let's attempt to wrap this up as concisely as we can without cutting it too short, I guess. I wanted to talk about personal journeys and what have you, but I don't think it's actually appropriate, because what I've found is that when you generalize, you come up with a lot of really profound stuff, even if it's incorrect. Like... Have you noticed that good stories, even if they're not true, can still be seen as just a really good story? You know what I'm saying?
Well, I used to work in fiction. I used to write fiction, so I understand that, yes, of course.
Of course. What do you think are some of the most important, perhaps, fictional lessons that people really need to wake up to?
Fictional lessons?
Yeah.
That's a very interesting question. Well, I think they need to learn to empathize with their child by projecting themselves 25 years into the future and imagining what kind of life their child is going to have if they do not start to take action to prevent the tyranny which is running amok from taking total, absolute control of every single aspect of life on Earth. And I think if people imagine themselves sitting in a grey, soulless tower block with thousands upon thousands of other people in a chemical sky, and if they imagine their children have been subjected to such chemical annihilation that they have no possibility of having children of their own, they have no possibility of ever not doing what they're told by the state, they have no freedom to do anything at all that isn't state controlled. And if they think that that lesson, that fictitious lesson, is not worth learning because there is no possibility of that type of dystopia coming about on this planet, they need to either pull their head from the sand or to pull it from their ass, because that's how they're living their life. And it happens to us all. There isn't anybody who isn't part of the control mechanisms, who hasn't been programmed, who hasn't suffered from social engineering. Even those of us who virtually rebelled from the very beginning and never done what we were told. You know, I bought the false left-right paradigm for 25 years of my life. You know, I thought that there could, that, well, I suppose that maybe that leads me to another important fictitious lesson that I learned. The lesson from the false left-right paradigm, that there's one common denominator in every single so-called political ideology. They're all fictions because they all hide one salient factor. Every one of them has a central bank, and is that central bank is bank's power and influence and control is unaffected by a government that is communist being replaced by a government that is corporatist. There is no difference.
Can you feel a change around you? Not just in yourself, but in everything, in everybody.
I can't, yes. Every fiber of my being feels like mankind has never had the opportunity that it has in this moment to rise up and do something better.
I think that a lot of people have this this sensation. It's very hard to describe what it is. It's like a cross between a heart palpitation, a mosquito bite, and tripping balls on ecstasy. It itches you, it hurts you, and it overpowers you with love at the same time.
Yes.
That's what it is. Very mild. It's right there, and I feel it. And it's tension, but tension that is full of promise.
Yes, I can completely empathize with that. This morning, when I found out about my friends being evicted so malevolently, there is no possible justification for treating anybody the way they were treated by the police. We live in an absolute total corporatist police state on this island. It's been imposed upon us. Anyone who doesn't realize that, they need to just look around them. And eventually, when I say eventually, it's happening now, Vinny. I don't know anybody who doesn't know somebody who's either having problems with the police or problems with the banks or problems with council tax, another bogus operation, problems with parking tickets, speed and fines. These are all victimless crimes. And when you go into a court and you say, but where is the victim? What have I done wrong? I didn't run anybody down. I didn't kill anybody. I didn't rob anybody of anything at all. And yet you're saying, I've got to pay this fine, even though the law says it's illegal. Because they're issuing these fines without a judgment. And that renders them all void under the Bill of Rights, if the Bill of Rights had any validity at all, which of course it doesn't.
Extraordinary is the system that we're getting. And one thing that's quite important, actually, is the mind-bendingly massive genius of the evil of the system, all right? And it's not like they, the psychopathic elite, are actually genius. What I think they've done is they've indoctrinated everybody into a belief structure and captured the genius over the last few centuries of inventors, politicians, artists, and many other walks of life that have influence on the society as a whole. They've indoctrinated them, captured their creativity, and exploited it for their purposes, not ours.
Yes.
To reverse such a system, and we were talking during the break about satanic reversion, how they'll take something good and just turn it upside down, make it evil. Like a star, for example, is actually really good. It symbolizes the head, the arms, and the legs, and how they're all tied together. It's a spiritual kind of thing, and then they invert it, literally turning a human potential on its head in order to use it as a negative energy spectrum. And I think what we're doing now, just as a generalization, what we're attempting to do is invert it back, because the permanent position of the star, meaning representation of humanity, whether it be on a flag or in the sky, has been turned upside down in a semi-permanent way, so that we don't even recognize the right side up anymore. And what we're attempting to do is simply put it back in its place, like something that's really important that has fallen off the mantelpiece that nobody has ever bothered to try and pick up before, because they don't even realize it's fallen off.
The general principles of natural law, as brilliantly described by Marc Passio in his latest video extravaganza. I highly recommend anybody who hasn't seen these videos to invest the time, because it truly is worth it. It's very hard to even stop watching for 7 hours. It's very, very hard, as you were saying yourself before. Because the general principles of natural law are the foundations of the Treaty of Universal Community Trust. This is what we're seeking to bring about. And this treaty, there is nothing in international law which affects adversely the validity of this treaty. There is no possible valid legal objection to this treaty. The only thing that the communities, the indigenous sovereign nations standing under Universal Community Trust, the only thing we do not currently have is explicit formal recognition from already recognized independent sovereign nations. But while I can't say too much at the moment, we have in the offing, we're about to enter discussions with two already recognized sovereign nations. And once this happens, that will mean that UCT, Universal Community Trust, will have established upon these shores a new postal district, B, a new diplomatic district, and C, an alternative to the tyrannical system that has been imposed upon the world.
In other words, if you were to talk to the tyrannical system directly about UCT, it's there specifically to expose UCUNTS.
Correct. That's right. And to help everyone understand what needs to be done to reverse the system, to reverse engineer the ill effects of globalization and scumbaggery.
Well, haven't you noticed it's actually quite interesting is that physics saying for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. There was a story that I heard, and again, this is one of those stories that may or may not be true, but it's still a good story. There was a book in ancient Rome that allegedly had the future in it. And the Romans fought countless skirmishes to obtain this book. And when they read it, it told them that all of their grain would rot and that Rome would starve. And so in an effort to prevent this future, Rome confiscated the grain from everybody and put it all in one place. And then it went moldy and they starved. Sometimes the very efforts that we put in place to prevent things from happening are indeed the progenitors of what we wish to prevent.
Exactly.
And I think that the elite themselves have sowed the seeds of their own demise by attempting to suppress our individuality, by attempting to suppress freedom, by attempting to suppress creativity. It has grown an even stronger urge of freedom and creativity within people who have managed to see it for what it is.
What they being the elite, what they never imagined was the unexpected qualities of every man and woman when their backs are pressed against the wall. The unexpected can always happen in those circumstances. Now, who do you know who is not having a hard time at the moment, Vinny? How many people do you know?
My mate Jono, but his, well, the thing is, actually, people always have a hard time with everything, right? However, yes, you don't get affected by all hard times at the same time, right? Yeah. Let's say, for example, some people are suffering a bit of financial stress, but they've got a really good relationship with their partner, for example, that helps them through it. Some people have really bad relationships with their partners and it's really stressing them out, yet they've got no money worries. You see what I'm saying? In one way or another, inexorably, we're all being fracked at the same time.
That's right. That's right. And one thing that I have to say, that if there'd been anybody else who had done what I've done before I did it, I wouldn't have done it their way. I would have still done it my way. And if there's anything that I've tried to stress at all of the conferences or talks that I've given, it's first you've got to lose the fear. And once you lose the fear, you've got to understand there is no shortcut. There is no silver bullet. You've got to do this yourself. You've got to realize that you are a sovereign being, that you cannot be subjugated without breaching natural law. Everything that is happening to you that you don't like, you have a choice not to do it, not to participate, not to be complicit in the slaughter of innocence in your name. Mm-hmm. You can't say no to the tax man. You can't say no, I'm not going to register me children. You can even deregister your children. And it makes a massive financial impact upon the crown. We had it confirmed. There was a health worker came around to our house just to make sure that our daughter was doing all right once we refused to register. We were completely open about it. We opened the door, said, look, come in. You can see that she's thriving. We got nothing to hide here because we knew they'd leave us alone if we did this. And that's exactly what happened. And on the final time the health worker came, my daughter, who was two at the time, ran to the door, opened the door and says, come on in, have a cup of tea. And from that moment, she was completely charmed. She ticked all the boxes and says, you know what? I will get into trouble for saying this, but I think what you're doing is the future of parenting. And that's someone who works for the state. It's like she's ticking the boxes because she's doing that for her job, but she realizes what she's doing is not what's right for children. And she's virtually admitting that.
Mm. Well, I think it's like you need to put the examples in front of people. You know, I hear so many people who are only freshly woken up to this truth and still have many years of research, experience, relationship building and, shall we say, lifestyle changes to go through before they actually achieve their balance, have found their, found their chi, so to speak. And I think what's interesting is that instead of focusing on improving themselves, they mistakenly focus on hating on others. You're a slave, you're dumb, you're asleep, you're crazy, you believe in this insane system. While those things are true, is that you're prioritizing attacking others rather than defending yourself, and that makes you weak.
Yes, it does. It always does. There is absolutely no point in furthering the cause of divide and conquer, which they have used so often. You know, how many times have you suspected that there was an agent in your midst since you started doing this?
Not really ever, actually. Because the only time when there actually was an agent in my midst, somebody hacked his account and got a fax that he sent to the FBI saying, "Why aren't you protecting me from these people that are exposing me?"
Very good.
You know, so when
in
it comes
case, to, I have, sorry, go on.
There was a story about how Hitler managed to divide and conquer his political competition in the 30s, the early 30s, late 20s, I think. It was called Mr. Schmidt. Okay, he would come into his to communist meetings and so on and so forth, his political rivals, and he would tell everybody that there is a Mr. Schmidt in the room, who is an agent who is trying to destroy their party. There was no Mr. Schmidt. But because everybody believed that there was, they started accusing each other and infighting, and then they were really surprised when this relatively unknown new political party rose so massively to power with so little opposition. And I think that's what's happening in the truth movement now, is that we have people within our midst who are simply telling us that there is a Mr. Schmidt when there isn't a Mr. Schmidt.
Well, I do understand where you're coming from with that, but I have had a completely different experience, which I'll now attempt to relate. I'll tell you that the first part of it, I got put on an MI5 watch list. Because I was down to make a series for the BBC when 9/11 happened, and I was meeting with heads of department, and I had some very influential producers on board with this TV series that I was writing, and I just had a conversation in the BBC canteen waiting for this guy as a head of department who was meeting us in the canteen for some reason, and I just had a conversation with a couple of producers I was with and said, "Yo, what do you think about 9/11, man? That something was definitely wrong there." He says, "Oh, you don't want to start talking like that. No, that nothing could be further from, I don't even want to discuss it. Straight away, shut down in flames." But of course, I wouldn't let it go, so I keep, no, you obviously haven't looked at it. It was this had been written, it was scripted. Surely you must have seen that all the press releases must have been written in advance. They couldn't possibly get all that information together so quickly. And they go, no. And that people were listening, you know. And I thought, no, I didn't give a shit. I really didn't give a shit. But nevertheless, not for the first time in my life, it did come home to roost. Because it's like all of a sudden, no one is interested in doing anything. They're letting me down as gently as possible. They don't want to provoke me. But suddenly everything just gets shut down. And then I found out that a couple of left-wing film directors were actually blacklisted in the 70s and 80s for their communist beliefs. And this was during a time when one of them's called Ken Loach, who's very famous. And this was at a time when MI5 had an office at the BBC. They had an office at the BBC until 1981. And the BBC claimed they were using an office in the building, nothing more. Oh, not vetting every single BBC employee, including the stars, so-called, etc. Well, from that point, you see, I knew my communications were being bugged because I heard them on the line. You know, it was barbaric by comparison, the technology then. You know, it was easy to pick up. And I moved from London to Amsterdam. And I was living in a great place in Amsterdam, having a fantastic time. But I kept noticing people at the airport. I mean, I thought, you're getting paranoid. You're imagining it. It's not true. And then this one day, I was taking a flight on my own to Scandinavia. And I noticed there was a really odd-looking guy in Bermuda shorts and a flowery shirt carrying a bag. And he was looking at me. And he seemed to be everywhere I was, looking at me and then looking away. And so I thought nothing. I thought, right, I'm just going to get on with my business. And I went through passport control. He's just behind me. I put all the bags through, and I'm just picking up my bags at the end. All of a sudden, he puts his hand on my arm, said, "Where are you going? And what have you got in your bag?" I said, it's just been through the X-ray. Well, and who are you? And he pulls out his badge, and it was Dutch undercover police, and they've been tracking me. He said, what have you got in there? I said, I've got some contracts in there. I'm taking them to a meeting in Denmark. You know, check. What did you think I had in there? Coke. And he's like, well, we didn't know. I said, come on, man, I've just been through the X-ray machine. What are you doing? And anyway, he couldn't do anything. He had to walk away. But from that point onwards, I was quite wary of him. Mm. So I get back to the flat, and I tell my wife at the time what had gone on. And, I mean, you know, we did laugh it off. But a few days later, we noticed that there was a flat across the canal from us. And there was a red light in the window. And it was an empty flat. And a red light just appeared from nowhere. There could have been a camera. And anyway, so we let it go past a few weeks, thought we'd humour them, and lo and behold, we could make out a camera in certain lights. There was a camera on the windowsill, and then a curtain appeared, and it was poking through a gap in the curtain. So I decided I would take the piss a little bit. So we had a balcony, and one Saturday morning, I rolled up a big fat one, and it really was a big fat one, and I put on my wife's purple dressing gown backwards with shades and a bandana, and I went out, and I waved at the camera, and then I turned round and pulled the dressing gown apart and showed them my two big, fat, hairy ass cheeks. And within a few hours, they were gone, and they never came back. There was no light, there was no camera. Yeah. It was wound up.
Yeah.
And I haven't really worried about it since then, but I've been aware of their presence. They have made a few moves.
Oh, yeah. And, My story about the Mr. Schmidt is just how you can sabotage other people who are otherwise genuine. That's not to say that just because you're paranoid that nobody's following you.
That's right.
You know, because it does exist. The system does exist, and it's a big quagmire of suspicion. And what my point was is that if you're ultimately suspicious of absolutely everybody around you, just suspicious without any evidence for being suspicious, that's when you start destroying not only your own life and your social circles, but you start destroying your potential to actually positively influence those social circles. That's what's happened. I've seen so many people activists who have lost all social cohesion. You can't even have a conversation with these people. All the things that they're talking about with the scumbaggery and what have you checks out. It's absolutely accurate. But they don't have any relationships with people that last because they get suspicious so easily and their suspicions can never be quashed.
No, they can't.
Regardless of the amount of evidence.
That's why you have to give everyone the benefit of the doubt from the beginning. And you always know in your heart whether you can trust someone. You give them the benefit of the doubt regardless, even if you feel a bit uneasy. And I've never had that uneasy feeling, and I've never seen it develop into a situation where I could trust someone. I always knew immediately that I could trust the people that I trust. And it's always been that way, but I've always trusted my instincts on that. Mm. Nevertheless, I do also know that in 2008, via Google Ads, MI5 was advertising for operatives, and they were sending these advertisements to the job centres in Britain, and they were recruiting low-level operatives to basically spread rubbish, crap, and to be agents provocateurs on certain radical forums. And I've seen this again and again. You know, people will derail threads and the discussion just ends up going nowhere.
This is why on Twitter, Facebook and YouTube, which I use fairly regularly, there is a function on them that I think is the most important thing for everybody who uses these platforms to know and know how to use properly. The block function.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. Because you get all of these people, all of these scum, they have no thing at all that is in any way contributing to the conversation. It's derailing it, it's destroying it, it's changing it from its intended purpose. Once you notice those people, and they give themselves away, it's kind of like, you know when somebody with awful body odor walks into a room, you can frickin' smell them? It's kind of like that. It's sort of like this intellectual, dishonest odor that they exude, and you can just... It takes a while. I think my 7 years of exposing to scumbaggery? I'm in my seventh year. It's taken a while for me to actually sort of get it. And now it's kind of like I don't even intellectualize it anymore. Before I had to think, before I had to analyze, before I had to question. But now it's like by instinct, just kind of like how a Marine can take apart and strip a weapon without looking at it.
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. It's something similar has been said about myself a few times by one of my closest associates. So I understand where you're coming from. You can smell them. You can't smell them. You're right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that this is a decent place to wrap it up. I want to thank you very much for your time today and your honesty. And I actually do want to recommend specifically that people do check out your other works and what have you, because it's, despite this conversation being really, really good and in depth, it's not all there is to you. It's insufficient. There is more of higher value for the listeners to go and check out. And I want to encourage you just personally, listeners, just go and frickin' do it, okay? Just go and do it, all right? I pay taxes to a degree, but my justification for doing that is so that I can interview all the people who don't and can teach you how to not do it either, so that one day I can hopefully contribute to a society where it will be recognized 100% for the fraud that it is, and those who refuse to pay them do not get the consequences that those who are pioneering the road ahead today are suffering from. And I want to thank you for taking it on the chin on behalf of myself and basically the entire human race who you, by proxy, are attempting to free. And it's an incredibly honorable thing, and it speaks well of humanity as a whole that people like you still exist despite all of the machinations of scumbaggery that are around us every day.
Well, thank you from the bottom of my heart and right back at you, because, you know, it's not an easy thing to do, you know, either what you're doing or what I'm doing, and I think there's a lot of crossover as well. And I want to thank you for inviting me on your program and giving me the opportunity to spread this information further than it's ever been spread before. And I would be absolutely delighted to come back and talk again if ever you wanted to invite me. So,
Now, could you please recite your website one last time, and then we're all done.
It is self-realization.com. And I would also like to give a little plug to a new website that's just been launched this week by another trustee of UCT. It's called roguemail.org. And you can see a lot of very brilliant, prescient work on that site. I think that's about it for the plugs.
All right. Well, actually, one more. This is a listener-supported broadcast, ladies and gentlemen. Without you and your donations, the show would not exist. I also want to thank you, the listeners who donate for this. Also, I am moving house and getting married, and my Mrs. Muffler on her car has broken in half, so I need about $2,500 within the next week or so. So if it's at all possible, if there's anybody out there who hasn't currently been bankrupted by the system, I'm sure there's like three, please donate some money at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. Make a donation either into the bank account or through PayPal, and there's also a subscribe button there as well, so you can make regular contributions so that I can basically ease back on the begging for donations, because I only really beg for them when I really need them. And today I am begging you, begging please, begging on my knees at the VinnyEastwoodShow.com. That's Vinny with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead, make my news.
Thank you very much.
You are the only exception for you.